Good afternoon. I will call the Higher Education Finance and Policy Committee to order. I am clearly not your regular co-chair. Senator Rarick is out today, and so she asked me to fill in for her, which I'm happy to do so. And before we, well, let's just go to the minutes right now. Do I have a motion to approve the minutes?
Madam Chair, I would move to approve the minutes of our February 19th, 2026 meeting.
Thank you for that, Mr. Co-Chair. The minutes are before us. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Minutes are adopted. Next, I will read through the safety rules here at the Capitol. Welcome to the Minnesota House of Representatives. We appreciate your interest and participation in the legislative process. To ensure everyone can view, hear, and understand today's proceedings, we ask for your cooperation in maintaining decorum and civility throughout this hearing. For the safety, security, and comfort of all attendees, please note the following guidelines. I, the committee chair, maintain control of these proceedings and establish the following expectations. Signs and placards are not permitted in the hearing room. Verbal outbursts, shouting, or disruptive behavior will not be tolerated. Applause or other audible demonstrations are not allowed. For safety reasons, standing or sitting in walkways and aisles, or standing or obstructing at your chair is prohibited. If you require any accommodation, please speak with our Sergeant of Arms, identified by their gold ties. Troopers and House security personnel are present to ensure everyone's safety. Those providing testimony will be given specific time limits which must be strictly observed. If you receive an entrance ticket, please retain it as it may be required for re-entry if you leave the hearing room. Failure to comply with these guidelines may result in the removal from the hearing room. Our goal is to conduct these proceedings efficiently while ensuring everyone the opportunity to observe and participate appropriately. The chair will now outline specific procedures for today's hearings, which I don't have any specifics. So there are the rules. With that, we will move on to a presentation we have this morning. There's a shortfall in the grant program, and we're going to hear about that from the testifiers at the table. So please introduce yourselves and continue on with your testimony.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and good afternoon, Chair Scott, Co-Chair Wolgamont, members. For the record, my name is Dennis Olson. I'm proud to serve as the Commissioner of the Minnesota Office of Higher Education, and thank you for the opportunity to address the committee here this afternoon to talk through our state financial aid programs and primarily the Minnesota state grant. We realized walking into the room that my name appeared at the top of the PowerPoint, and so figured I should come up and at least introduce the presentation. But we have two incredible folks here from OHE who will introduce themselves and lead the presentation. I'll leave the testifier table here, but I'll, of course, be around for any questions that may arise, and we also have other members from the Office of Higher Education here as well who can help answer questions. But with that, Madam Chair, I'll turn it over to our other testifiers to introduce themselves and proceed.
Go ahead. Whoever's going first.
Good morning, committee members, Chair Scott, Co-Chair Wolgamont. For the record, my name is Megan Flores, and I'm the Director of State Financial Aid Programs at the Minnesota Office of Higher Education. We have several new members with us, as well as veteran members of the committee who we haven't been together for a while. So we thought we'd start out today by kind of reassessing and getting out some basic information about our largest state financial aid program, the Minnesota State Grant. And so I'll share some information about how the program operates, how students apply, how eligibility works, and then we'll walk through how we model spending for the program and discuss our current situation of demand for the program and eligible students exceeding the available resources. We'll also review what the statute directs OHE to do in this situation and then dive deeper a little bit into our projections as well as possible solutions. Happy to answer questions along the way. So how the state grant program operates is basically in order to be considered for the state grant and other Minnesota state financial aid programs, we have 14 of them. Students first complete the FAFSA, which is the free application for federal student aid. This is the annual universal application that is used across all states and territories in the United States to apply for federal aid. And most states also piggyback their state financial aid programs to that universal form. Students also need to complete an application for admission and be admitted to an institution. Schools typically don't issue a financial aid award notice if the student is not admitted. To complete the FAFSA, the student needs to create a federal student aid ID, which is commonly referred to as a student aid account. That requires submitting identifying information, including their address, their social security number, and other relevant information. This is required for all students, as well as the parent of students who are determined based on the Department of Education's definition of a dependent student, which is different than the IRS's definition of who's a dependent student. Those folks who are adding their additional information are referred to now as contributors. So when you file the FAFSA, the student is required to consent to have data directly pulled into it from the IRS. There's no longer the option to use what was known as the IRS data retrieval tool with the FAFSA Simplification Act. All applicants and their contributors have to consent or they are ineligible for federal and therefore student aid when they're applying via the FAFSA. The federal needs analysis, which is approved by the United States Congress, is the universal way that all applicants are measured for their financial need, and the result is known as the Student Aid Index, or the SAI, which we formerly used to call the EFC, or the Expected Family Contribution, prior to FAFSA simplification. That SAI is used to determine eligibility for need-based aid, and so the lower the Student Aid Index, the higher the applicant's need for assistance is. And with that FAFSA simplification, we now see a negative needs analysis, which demonstrates even more financial need. Additionally, the financial aid, federal student aid department within ED will flag certain records for additional verification, such as identity or income information, if there are oddities that are triggered on that FAFSA record. When we look at our state grant program, the Minnesota State Grant is our largest state financial aid program, both in terms of budget and the number of students who receive these funds. For the past almost 60 years, Minnesota has invested in a vibrant economy by recognizing the public good that an educated workforce provides our state. The Minnesota State Grant is a need-based aid program. It was established in 1969 to assist eligible Minnesotans pursuing undergraduate degrees at both public and private institutions in Minnesota. So it's not transportable. They have to use the grant at one of our schools here in the state. This slide here provides a snapshot for you of the activity for the program in our most recent year, as well as its impact. We've seen just over 75,000 students benefit from the program. Two-thirds of them are dependent students, and we have over 75, in fact, I think 80 or 81 institutions participating. There's just over $247 million as an annual appropriation to the program, and the average award last year was just under $3,000. About 60% of the recipients have an adjusted gross income of less than $40,000, and the vast majority of these students can be found attending our Minnesota public institution, with the large majority at our Minnesota State colleges and universities. The goal of the program is to distribute a finite amount of resources to the most amount of Minnesota resident students as possible to make the attainment of the credential they pursue a reality. The program is prohibited from operating on a deficit. And in order to avoid this, we carefully monitor spending as well as projections. The law actually requires that the Office of Higher Education issue public projections twice a year on November 1st and February 15th, and we share those projections with key stakeholders. When OHE performs those projections, we base them both on internal data that we have at the Office of Higher Education, as well as external data from other state agencies, as well as our campus partners. The internal data involves a full simulation model of the last year of applicant data we have available. And then monthly, we're also comparing our cash flow, which is the disbursements we send to institutions on behalf of our students, to the projections that we have created. We also look at the analysis of FAFSA filing behavior to see if there are any trends or shifts we're seeing. The external data that we take into account for this work are the enrollment projections, which we receive directly from the schools, the tuition and fees, which we also receive directly from the public institutions, and then wage estimates from MMB for any state tax filers. When we looked at these different variables that come, those projections, sometimes they can actually change. When those projections change despite our best effort, it really has to do with the volume of inputs, and that shift can occur due to a variety of factors that are outside the agency's control. So, for example, we request estimated changes in tuition and fees, but our higher education partners are also estimating that because their boards do ultimately have to approve them, and that timeline doesn't always align. Enrollment can also change from what a school has projected and what they're anticipating. So that enrollment data, that changes can also be impacted by FAFSA formula changes, such as what we saw with the FAFSA simplification process. When we do those projections, we'll determine whether or not those parameters that are set in law need to be adapted in order to compensate for either underspending of available resources or if we need to adjust for a projected deficit. And when there is a deficit, which historically has been rare, there have been, I believe, four times in the last 24 years that we've had a deficit. But what we can do is either request additional funds from the legislature. We can make changes to the statute, which there is an insufficient appropriation portion of the statute, which directs us exactly how to make those changes. Or we can request to this body that parameter changes are made in order to balance the budget within the program. As soon as we do know about those changes in the formula or the parameters, we communicate those with our campus partners. Students are notified about their financial aid awards when they complete the FAFSA annually each year, or the state financial aid application, and then the Department of Ed releases that FAFSA data when the students select which schools they want their data sent to. OHE does receive all of those records as well. Sometimes those FAFSA data records that are sent to the institution, there's a little bit of a delay. It's really cut down because of some of the things with FAFSA simplification, but they do fairly quickly get those. Once the college or university receives that FAFSA data or the state aid application, they verify that indeed the student is a Minnesota resident. They determine the eligibility for the state grant based on our guidance we've issued, which are the parameters outlined in law. And then the student, one thing to note is that if a student is perhaps looking at several different institutions, especially if it's a two-year versus a four-year or a public versus a private, they might not get the same state grant award at each institution. They will see different dollar amounts on their award notice because those award sizes vary based on factors like tuition and fees and the availability of institutional aid. The students receive that estimated financial aid award notice typically electronically, and it includes all sources of aid, federal, state, and institutional forms of aid. Depending on when that award is issued, so for the institutions that issue estimated awards, often it will include that language. This is an estimated source. And that's because things like tuition and fees have not yet been set for the year, as well as the legislative session hasn't taken place in some cases, and in some cases we do not have that final Pell number, and so there's an estimate for that source as well. Factors that can change that award once the student got that estimate and then later receives in a revised award is that if the state grant is projecting a deficit, there is, like I mentioned, statutory language that tells us how to reduce those awards to cover the deficit. Again, we are mandated to issue parameters that project that the program will spend within available resources. The program may not operate on a deficit, so we have to balance. In times when we anticipate a shortfall, we are obligated to add a surcharge to the applicant's assigned family responsibility, as well as to increase the applicant's assigned student responsibility. And we need to do those in equal dollar amounts. other times that the award might change from that estimated until that revised award notice might be that the tuition and fees get set by the institution, and that can impact certain types of aid. The Pell Grant might come out with a finalized number, and that could change. And then there also could be things that happen, like I said, during the legislative session that create additional eligibility or change the parameters of different kinds of financial aid. So a lot of that change is happening. Other changes, such as the students plan to live on or off campus, whether they'll be full time, and then, of course, which institution they ultimately attend. Now we'll talk a little bit about how the FAFSA interacts specifically with the state grant. A few things that we were asked to highlight regarding the interplay between the federal landscape and our state landscape here in Minnesota as it relates to the Minnesota state grant is that that Pell Grant does play a critical role, and that we do take into account that Pell eligibility student has when determining the Minnesota state grant. And so when there is a shortfall in the Pell Grant program, that does put additional pressure on our state grant program. So if those federal Pell dollars come in shorter, then we have to make up for it or correspondingly cut our grants as well. Delays in the FAFSA processing can also create issues with our interplay there. And in that regard, that did happen that first year of FAFSA simplification. Fortunately, for the 24-25 aid year and the current 25-26 year, we are not seeing those delays, and things are running much smoother. Changes in that student aid index formula, which is something that is regulated by the federal Congress, is something that can impact the Minnesota state grant. So if there are, and as well as the volume of students with certain kinds of student aid index, that can impact the program as well. So if we see more students who demonstrate sizable financial need, that increases demand on the program. That also tells us who is pursuing college credentials in our state. Those changes in the Pell Grant formula really do have a very significant impact on our state grant, and so that's one thing that we're continuing to watch as the CBO is predicting a shortfall at that federal program as well. And then before I pass it over to my colleague Nicole Whalen, I want to do a little bit more of kind of, and Nicole will dig into our projections, but I do want to call the committee's attention to the modifications that were made to the program in the last legislative session. And so those changes that were approved in 2025 were the living and miscellaneous expense allowance was lowered from 115% of the federal poverty guideline to 106%. The assigned responsibility for dependent students was increased from 79% to 95%. The four-year tuition and fee cap was capped at 2% increase for each fiscal year, 26 and 27. The state deadline for the state grant program was moved from what matched the Pell Grant at the last day of the fiscal year to the 30th day of the term for which the student is applying for the grant. And then finally, the lifetime eligibility for the state grant, which did match the Pell Grant at the equivalent of 12 semesters of receipt of the grant, was moved down to eight semesters of receipt of the grant. So those are the most recent modifications we've had to the program. And with that, I'll go ahead and turn it over to Nicole.
Go ahead and state your name and continue on with your presentation. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Nicole Whalen, and I am the State Grant Research Manager at the Minnesota Office of Higher Education. So I will just pick up where Megan has left off and dig a little bit deeper into what is impacting our projection for this biennium. So to start us off, I have just a little recap of awards from last fiscal year. So this is looking at combined awards. So that would be average state grant awards and average Pell Grant awards by family income for fiscal year 25. So this this chart kind of shows how Pell Grants do tend to taper off above $50,000 family adjusted gross income, and then the state grant continues to fill in for those students at incomes above that level. So the grant really is targeted to middle income families, and it is relative to income and family size. So Megan alluded to the pending Pell shortfall. Excuse me. So currently the federal Pell Grant is projected to have a nearly $12 billion shortfall for the fiscal year 2027. That shortfall is caused largely by some of the same items that are impacting the state grant. So that is increased enrollment across the board, as well as increases in students who have the kind of the, are at the lowest end of the SAI spectrum. So students with the highest financial need. And sorry. For as far as state grant is concerned, that's something that does not immediately impact the state grant, but it is something we are watching. Any changes to the Pell Grant program has an outsized impact on state grant spending. For example, a $100 change in the annual Pell Grant maximum does typically have a $5 million per year increase or decrease in state grant spending. So that's that Pell shortfall is something that our office will continue to watch as the year goes on. So here we're looking at specifically some of the items that have impacted the state grant this biennium. So we have kind of two primary factors that are driving increases in state grant spending this biennium. The first is an increase in enrollment, which is paired with an increase in overall state grant applications. So the chart on the right there shows the degree to which changes in state grant applications have actually exceeded estimated and even actual changes in enrollment numbers. And that is true of most institutions across the state and all systems. And that that specifically the increase in state grant applicants drives state grant spending up pretty significantly as we see more eligible students receiving awards. Additionally, a much higher percent of those students have a high financial need. So we saw last year approximately 43% of students had an SAI of $0 or less, compared with fiscal year 2024, in which only 29% of the applicant file had an SAI, or excuse me, at that time it was labeled an EFC of $0 or less. So this fall, OHE projected a shortfall in both years of the biennium. In order to remedy this, we used our transfer authority to move funds from fiscal year 27 to fiscal year 26, and we reduced awards in fiscal year 27, again using our statutory authority to bring spending within appropriations. One thing I do want to note is although the shortfall is addressed for this biennium, this kind of deficit is likely to continue to occur in ongoing years unless we see a significant drop in enrollment. So this is a look at some of those numbers in a little bit more detail. In the table that's shown on the screen, we have the first line there are base resources for each year of the biennium, as well as a combined biennial total. And note that those base resources do reflect the transfer that we made from fiscal year 27 to fiscal year 26. So we did transfer approximately $60 million between years in the program. So you'll see the base resources for fiscal year 26 are $60 million higher, and vice versa, the base resources for 27 are $60 million lower. And then spending in fiscal year 27 does include the rationing parameters that we issued at the end of January, and those parameters do reduce awards for all students across the board. This leaves an approximately $8 million balance for the biennium, which for context is less than 2% of available resources in the program. So it is a very tight margin. And that is the end of our presentation. My apologies. So I think we're happy to take any questions.
All right, thank you. Are there member questions about the presentation? Chair Liebling.
Yeah, thank you. So since I'm still kind of new to this area, maybe I get to ask the question that was kind of like, well, duh, you should know that. I don't know. But one of you mentioned about the formula taking into account tuition at various institutions. Could you explain more about how it takes it into account? I mean, this is, I have to say, this is kind of a grim picture. It's really, so thank you for laying this all out for us. It is kind of distressing at a time when we have more need, you know. Of course, when the economy goes down, people want to enroll in school. And that, and this is really distressing that we're, looking like we're not going to be able to do so well for students in the future. But anyway, if you could address kind of how that plays in with the costs of the various institutions, it'd be helpful.
To whichever one of you would like to answer that.
Thank you, Chair Scott and Representative Liebling. The tuition, the way that it works with the state grant formula is that the amount that's recognized in the grant formula is capped at the highest price to your public institution in the state. So if there are any institutions that are private tuitions, which there aren't that many, that a student attends, none of those higher costs are recognized. On the four-year side, it had been has been capped in various different ways over the years. It currently capped the 24-25 highest-priced public four-year institution, which was the University of Minnesota Twin Cities, and then allowed only 2% increase from that in the first year of the biennium, and then another 2% in the second year of the biennium. So basically, even if the U of M is increasing their tuition by 7%, the law is only allowing a recognition of 2% of that increase in order to hold down that cap. That does have an impact on those U of M students, as well as all of the students who choose to attend a private institution and are Minnesota State Grant eligible. The students are impacted by that cap. So that's how the tuition cap is treated in the law.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the presentation. I didn't see anything in regards to the North Star Promise because that may have some interaction with how the state grant program is administered. Can you give us a little bit of background of how the two programs interact?
To the testifiers.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Knorr. Yes, you're correct. This did not address North Star Promise. So North Star Promise as a last dollar program is very, very heavily influenced by changes to the state grant formula. Because we have rationed awards for fiscal year 27 for state grant, that does increase North Star Promise awards for any student who is North Star Promise eligible and has financial need up to tuition and fees left over in their budget. So for the North Star Promise program, we do not, well, we have different, I would say we have different rationing measures in statute for that program, and the agency's decision for next year for that program was instead to institute a priority deadline. So we have announced a priority deadline of June 1st of 2026 to file the FAFSA to apply for the North Star Promise program, after which there's,
Excuse me, Chair Scott and Representative Knorr, I can also speak to that a little bit. So the way that the law addresses it within the North Star Promise, when there's also insufficient appropriation language in that program. However, it's a different language because it's a little bit different program, but they are definitely interrelated. And so the statute directs OHE to reduce program expenditures by determining the scholarship amount or number scholarships awarded that will fit within the appropriation. So again, our state constitution does not allow any of our programs to operate within a deficit, so we're forced to ration in some way, and then we look to see what does the statute tell us for how to ration. To ensure that North Star spending is within the projected available resources, we did, as my colleague alluded to, issue an estimated mandatory priority deadline of June 1st of 2026. That's for applicants for the 26-27 academic year next year. and we look at that deadline as our projections model that anyone who meets that deadline we'd be able to have spending for. We did also implement a couple of administrative changes that are within our purview to bring down the spending within the program. We will have, of course, a session, and if there are changes to the state grant program during the session, that either through statutory changes to how the state grant program operates, that as well as any additional appropriations would contribute to being able to change that estimated deadline. But essentially what it is in kind of summary is that the additional demand for the state grant program in higher enrollment and needier students applying and being eligible is putting a strain subsequently on the North Star Promise program as well, but not to the same extent.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So to that, you know, extent where we know that North Star Promise Act will also see diminished reserves in the process, so are we looking for other ways to balance the whole process whereby the last dollar coming in from North Star will fully pay for the students, or because of the lack of resources, we have to find other ways?
To the testifiers.
Representative Scott. Excuse me, Chair Scott, Representative Knorr. That is correct. Without additional resources or changes within the structural issues to the state grant program, we cannot do anything aside from follow what the law tells us to do when there are insufficient appropriations for the programs.
Representative Knorr?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Coulter.
Excuse me. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you both for being here. I would like to ask about the negative SAI piece. That was obviously, as we were figuring out the budget last year, that was a point of a great deal of conversation, we'll say. And I'm curious how much of that is a sort of depth versus distance issue. Like, to what extent is it, you know, a larger number of needier students applying, or is it students with a greater level of need than was previously anticipated because now we're counting some negative SAI? And I suspect it's probably a little bit of both, but I don't know if you're able to sort of quantify the difference there.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Coulter. I would say it is a bit of both. So as I mentioned earlier, we do see a much larger number of students at that very lowest end of the SAI spectrum, but I do know that of those students that are $0 or less SAI, the vast majority have a negative SAI. So I would say that both factors are in play, and I would say across the board, we have typically seen students with kind of a middle income or lower income family income, have had lower SAIs relative to the previous federal calculation that calculated an EFC. So it's a mixture of both.
Representative Coulter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. That's helpful to know. And I was thinking about this, and maybe I'm just like desperate to find silver linings right now, but in some sense, it sort of feels like both of these big issues are good problems to have. Like, we are having more folks apply to go to college, which is a good thing, and we are having more folks with lower incomes who traditionally have been left out of higher education apply too. So those, I think, are both good problems to have, but don't make them any easier to solve. So I think we're gonna have to have some serious conversations moving forward about what the state grant program looks like and how we serve students and all of that. So. Thank you.
Representative Cleburne.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think this is technically the third slide, the State Grant 101. You state that most of the recipients attend public institutions, and then you have 61% at Minnesota State College and Universities and 17% at the University of Minnesota. Is that correct? So that'd be a total of 78%.
To the testifiers.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, that is correct.
Thank you so much. Could you please tell me, so that means we have about 22% who attend private colleges. Is that correct?
Representative Cleaborn to the testifiers.
Sorry. It's okay. Apologies.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, that is correct.
Representative Cleaborn.
Oh, my gosh. You know, it gets so complicated. Can you please tell me roughly the total amounts that go to the public students and the total amount that go to the private college students? Do you have that information with you?
To the testifiers.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do have that number.
Thank you.
So I will say, I'll start with the private institutions. The total state grant dollars that went to those institutions in fiscal year 25 was approximately $80.5 million.
Okay.
And the total for public institutions in fiscal year 25 was approximately $142 million.
Okay. And do you have... Oh, apologies again, Madam Chair. Sorry, I'm in my headspace. Okay. And can you please tell me, and maybe you can give this to us later, the average award, because what I heard you say, and the reason I'm asking this question always, and I keep pushing this year after year, is that when you tie the private colleges to the highest four-year, not the colleges, but the universities, to the highest four-year public, the average tends to be higher to the public, to the private college student, in my understanding, than to the students attending our Minnesota State four-year institutions.
To the testifiers, if you...
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I would say by and large that is correct. The average award last year at our Minnesota private for-profit institutions was... $5,300. The University of Minnesota system did have the highest average award at around $5,600. And then our state universities, the average award was $2,500 last year.
Chair Cleaborn?
Madam Chair, thank you. I just want to bring that to the attention of the committee, right? As we're looking at ways to more evenly distribute the funds. If you're attending a four-year institution that is a public institution, the students attending our state universities are getting less than half of the students who are attending private schools, while the quality of education may be exactly the same. I just want to raise that for the committee. Thank you.
Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to the testifiers. I wanted to go back to this SAI issue. Well, first, can I ask two questions?
Absolutely.
Okay, so first I want to go back to, like, the $60 million shortfall. So in June, when we were changing all the levers and trying to make all this work, I was shocked to see the shortfall, because we felt like we had solved for this situation. So when did you get those enrollment projections to know? How soon after we had the special session did this become apparent that we were still going to be $60 million short?
To the testifiers.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Robbins. So I typically project state grant spending in November and February of each year. So once the fiscal year has closed out, which for state grant closed out, it was fully closed out by September, that is when I have that information and I'm able to really dig in and look at projecting spending for at least the current aid year. And then I receive information on projected changes in enrollment. I received those updated numbers from our systems in October.
Okay. Chair Robbins?
Thank you. So now I want to go on to the negative SAI issue. So in your presentation, you say 43% of the students had an SAI of zero or less, compared with 29% in 24. But you don't say how, what I'm looking for is how many of the students that have the negative SAI got the full 1,500. Can you give us a breakdown of how much of this shortfall is driven by the negative SAI?
To the testifiers.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Robbins. I do not have that number immediately in front of me. What I can say is that of students who had a negative SAI last year, overwhelmingly, almost all of them had a negative 1,500 SAI. We did not see a lot of folks who were in between zero and negative 1,500. Typically, they were either zero or they were negative 1,500 with a few, you know, a few by state grant standards is probably a few hundred people with something in between those two numbers.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And was that accounted for in your projections? Had you anticipated that?
To the testifier.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Robbins. The short answer is yes. So when our office began projecting spending for fiscal year 25, I believe we first projected that spending in fiscal year 23. So that was after the FAFSA Simplification Act had been announced. However, we did not have any formal guidance from the Federal Department of Education on what that would look like in terms of implementation. So what I can say is that I went through federal appropriations language and essentially created code to calculate, well, based on the information I have from last year, what will this student's SAI look like next year? As the federal timeline continued, we did finally get some of that guidance, and we did find that in some ways it very significantly differed from some of our assumptions. And in fact, the federal Congress was making changes to that act right up until the spring prior to implementation. So our estimates did change over time. And so although we did anticipate that there would be a large proportion of students that had a negative 1,500 SAI, we did underestimate, I think by around 11,000 students, how many, like, total count-wise would have a negative 1,500 SAI. And that is true kind of nationwide, I would say. From anecdotally what we've heard from other states, is that a lot of folks were surprised by how many students received that negative 1,500 SAI, how many students received maximum Pell Grant awards. And that also is a piece that's playing into the projected Pell shortfall as well, as the federal government also did not adequately project how many students would be receiving maximum Pell Grant awards.
Chair Robbins?
One more, sorry.
Go ahead.
Thank you for that. And I get it's not an exact science. It's hard. But I'm assuming, you know, we're incorporating these learnings as you're going into the next model year. So there's a lot of concern in our last hearing about ghost students. Do you have any tracking on the people who had got the negative SAI? Did they stay enrolled?
To the testifiers.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Robbins. I do not personally have that information. Is that something? Do you have any?
Go ahead.
Madam Chair, Representative Robbins, that would be something at the school level that they would probably have a better sense of how many of the max negative 1,500 SAI students retained from year to year. So that isn't something that we are per se tracking on an individual student basis. We're tracking overall aggregate number of students mm-hmm. who stay within that pool of the highest need, but not necessarily was it the same student from year to year.
Chair Robbins?
So I think you should be asking for that data from each school and letting mm-hmm. us know. That's very important. Thank you.
Thank you. Have Representative Coulter again, and then Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sorry to take a second bite at the apple here. But something that you, Representative Clewarn, asked kind of piqued my interest. If you have these numbers on hand, great. I'm not going to be upset if you don't. But you mentioned average awards like through the University of Minnesota system. I would think that would represent a pretty significant spectrum. I would think average awards at Morris, for example, would look very different. Do you have the breakdown by campus in front of you? And then my second question on that, which I would be very impressed if you had, is if you have a breakdown between Minnesota State colleges and universities. Again, I would think, you know, Winona State and Normandale would have a pretty significant difference as an example there.
To the testifiers.
Thank you, Chair Scott and Representative Coulter. Yes, thanks to my colleague who has printed out our state grant end of year projections report. I do have that information in front of me. So yes, I will say that although the average for the University of Minnesota system was $5,600 last year, that varies. So the smallest average grant was awarded at Crookston, and that average was around $3,600. And then the average at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities was around $6,000 last year. And then specifically looking at the state colleges and the four-year institutions, so our state colleges do have lower tuition fees than our Minnesota State four-year universities. So the average Minnesota State grant at the state colleges last year was around $1,100. And the average at the Minnesota State universities was around $2,500. And that does vary by campus as well, although there's not as much variance. The lowest average award was at Metropolitan State University, and that was $2,100. And then the highest average award was at Winona State University, and that was around $2,800.
Representative Coulter.
Okay.
Representative Novotny.
Thank you. Maybe I missed it, pointed out if I did. Does it break down how many undocumented students are receiving the state grant through the state aid application, and what's the total cost of that to the taxpayers? I'm asking this because if they're undocumented, they're not going to be eligible for the federal programs, right, like Pell Grant or anything like that. And so this is the potentially the last and only bucket, so they're going to be getting potentially more. So what does that break down to?
To the testifier.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Novotny. We do not have an estimate of how many students are undocumented who receive the grant. We do have information on students who do qualify for the state grant by applying via the Minnesota DREAM Act application, and that is available to students who are undocumented and also to a wide variety of students who are otherwise ineligible to file a FAFSA form but may be in this country legally. And my colleague can speak more to the mechanics of eligibility for that. I will say there were approximately 620 state grant recipients last year who received awards via the Minnesota DREAM Act application, and that total dollars was around $4.9 million.
Want to add anything? Go ahead.
Madam Chair, Representative, as far as what my colleague mentioned about other statuses, so students who apply via the Minnesota DREAM Act application are any student who's a resident student under our state law who is ineligible to file the FAFSA. So that doesn't only include undocumented students. It also includes students who have asylum pending, students who have temporary protective status, students who have DACA, students who have other legally present or lawfully residing statuses that are ineligible to file the FAFSA but do meet state resident student definitions. And so those 620 students aren't all undocumented students.
Representative Botney.
Okay, I got lost in some of those numbers there, but I'd like to follow up with that later, if, you know, get clarification on that. But my rough guess, rough math here, 620 Dreamers, 4.9 million, 7,900. That's about a average number? Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
And yes, I would like to break that down and get it in writing.
I have a question for OHE to the testifiers. So we have this deficit, and so what are you all doing to try to prevent that in the future, since it seems to be trending in a particular way? Are you, besides just trying to get more state money, are there other things that you're looking at implementing or changes that you can make in the future so we have a better idea of when these shortfalls might occur? Go ahead, Ms.
Chair. Excuse me. Apologize for that. I was just looking to my colleagues here to the right. We do have an internal working group and some other avenues that we're exploring to look at a new model for our primary need-based state aid program. And so we are looking into other models that might be a better option for our state. That's not something that we would not want to do quickly. It's something we would want to do very cautiously to make a data-driven decision based on our own state, our population, and the behaviors of the institutions in our state. But we are indeed engaging in some internal work groups to discuss potential models that might look very different from the current model.
All right, thank you for that. And if you could just give us an update on that periodically, that I know the members of this committee would be very appreciative of that. Representative Cleaver.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I realize we've been having this discussion for a while now, and I don't think we ever defined for the public what SAI means.
Yeah, it's in the packet.
No, I know for us. I'm just saying for anybody who might be listening, I mean, most of us know what it is, but we never really defined it. So if you could just define it for the public listening, that would be
great. Ms. Flores or Ms. Whalen?
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative, thank you for the question. So the FAFSA form is beholden to the Federal Needs Analysis Formula. And the Federal Needs Analysis Formula and what is taken into account and how the math is done is outlined in federal statute. So it's federal law, how federal needs analysis work. And there are adjustments to it over the years, the 30-some years I've been working in this industry. But that federal needs analysis, the result of that math, used to always be called the expected family contribution. When a applicant completes the free application for federal student aid, the FAFSA, that resulting number is basically an index. It doesn't mean that's what the student will be obligated to pay, nor what their higher education journey will cost for that given aid year, but it's an index that's then used to be plugged into federal aid formulas, state aid formulas, and university or school-based funding. Often private sources also look at that. It's a universal way to measure all students the same and have an output or result. That result through the FAFSA Simplification Act was changed from being called expected family contribution, which was found to be confusing, just that wording alone, expected family contribution. And it now is called the Student Aid Index to more closely align with what the number really is. It's an index of a relative strength or ability for a family to provide or lack thereof ability to contribute towards the student's education. And that same formula is used universally across the entire country, all U.S. states and territories, when someone files the FAFSA form.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Flores.
Manager, follow up?
Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Chair Claiborne.
Well, I have two other really quick things,
okay,
if I may. So one, I want to thank you both for your tremendous work. I mean, I am always so impressed with OHE, and I'm incredibly impressed every time you testify what a great job you do, and knowing the information and providing it to us in a clear way that we can easily understand. So I just want to express my gratitude for the work that you do for us and for the people of our state. So I just want to say that. I feel like a broken record, if I may continue.
Yes, Madam Chair.
So when the question was asked earlier about the state grant, and I do love the state grant report, so I also want to say thank you for that great work. And you talk about the average state grant to the state universities, our four-year institutions, right? So when my colleague asked the question, like, what are the averages, right? When I go to that very same report and you talk about the University of Minnesota, the average there, I think you said, was $5,600, and Crookston was $3,600. I just want to put this out there for the public also. And again, these are just numbers, so I'm not in any way attacking your work, okay? Because it's what we, the legislature, have required you to do, right? So the onus is on us. But I do want to make sure that people understand this. You know, so if we have a student attending Augsburg, for example, and I'm not picking on Augsburg, they're a fine institution, right? Their student would receive an average state grant of $6,500, where the U of M student would only receive the average of $5,600, right? So when I look at these numbers and I think, okay, why, right? I mean, why is there not more uniformity around this? And so you see $6,300, $6,300, $6,364 going to private colleges where the average at the most expensive Minnesota State or Minnesota College is the U of M, and they get $5,600 average. So you see what I mean? It's like you have 20% of the students receiving, I believe, 34% of the money. And as we are looking at how this deficit is growing, we need to make sure that the dollars, students all need to pay for their education. They need to be more evenly distributed somehow. And I think when we look at it always, our Minnesota State universities are equivalent or, in some cases, in my opinion, and it's just my opinion, better than some of these institutions where the students receive a much, much higher state grant allocation. So I'm just trying to raise that awareness for the group, but it has, you are doing exactly what we ask you to do, so it's on us. I'm not blaming you. Thank you.
Do you want them to respond to that, or you were just kind of putting it out there? Okay, because I thought maybe you were asking them to, like, change the formula or something like that. Okay. Well, I bet you do. Yeah. All right. Representative Allen.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had a question for the testifiers. I was just kind of thinking, how does the Minnesota's reliance on the federal Pell Grants within the state grant formula increase taxpayers' exposure when federal policies change? And should the state reconsider this automatic stacking model that we currently have?
Whichever one of you want to take that, or both of you?
Go Madam ahead, Chair, Flores. Representative, thank you for bringing up that. As we continue to explore a model, the potential for a new model, one of our primary focuses is sustainability, predictability for this body, for us as an agency, as well as for our students and families, which I would say is the most important piece of the puzzle. Having a reliable, predictable, sustainable model that students and families can get an award that is more stable from year to year is really important for those students to be able to plan for the future. They do have to reapply for aid both from the federal government and the state government every single year, and it's very difficult, and the impact, I can't underscore how devastating it can be to actual students who are pursuing their credentials, whether that's a one-year program, a two-year program, or a four-year program. When they're making plans ahead of time and things change, it's very difficult. The student and the family can't suddenly work more or make more, or if there aren't resources to draw on, those can't just happen anywhere. At the state level, we're also somewhat in a bind, as well as at the federal level. My colleague mentioned about the federal government having the shortfall of, you know, our equivalent of being $60 million off, they were $12 billion off. You know, the modeling is not an exact science. We try our very best. We use the best and all the data we have available. But I do think that your question is a worthwhile question on, does it make sense to tie our state aid model to the federal model? And I think that's something that could and should be explored.
Representative Allen, are you good?
I'm good. Thank you.
All right, very good. Representative Schwartz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, testifiers, for coming down today. I appreciate your time. I was just wondering, how many students are receiving state grants through the state aid application rather than the FAFSA, and what is the average award that those students are receiving.
To the testifiers, Ms. Whalen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Schwartz. Yes, so that number was roughly 620 students in fiscal year 25 for an average grant of around $8,000.
Representative Schwartz.
I do have a follow-up question. And how does OHE verify financial information without federal cross-checks?
Ms. Whalen? Or Ms. Flores?
Yep, Madam Chair, Representative. The Minnesota DREAM Act application, our state financial aid application, the needs analysis formula is modeled exactly after the federal needs analysis formula. So the students are measured the same. A family from a similar socioeconomic background who files the FAFSA and also files our state aid application receives the same resulting student aid index. As far as the verification, we do all of that in-house at the Office of Higher Education on behalf of those students across the state. And I believe your specific question was about the federal data. Since we do not have the direct data exchange, we collect the tax forms directly from the students and their contributors.
Representative Schwartz.
Thank you. That's all.
I noticed there's a third testifier at the table. Is this were you prepared with some remarks, or were you just there for moral support?
Moral support.
Moral support. Okay. Very good. Any other member questions? Representative Liebling.
Thank you. So when this is more of a data question, but when you were talking about the new rules about checking everything against the federal database, and you know that in order to, I guess, generally apply, you have to file the FAFSA, and the FAFSA gets checked and all that. So the data that students in Minnesota are supplying on their FAFSA in order to get their federal and state grants, what happens to that data? Is that data, what are the feds doing with that data? Do we know? And what is Minnesota doing with that data?
Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, the federal data as well as the state under our partnership with the federal government is protected by federal privacy laws. And so the data is privately protected, which I believe your question may be related to, is concern about the student data and the protection of that data. And so the data is very strict. The FERPA, the Federal Privacy Act, is very strict in how the data can be used, who it can be shared with. And the FAFSA Simplification Act actually strengthened that in what they consider federal tax information. And there are very specific and narrow spaces in which OHE can redisclose that data in aggregate amounts that are not individually identifiable. The schools are beholden to that same standard as is the federal government. Does that answer your question?
Of course, I like this line of questioning. Go ahead, Chair Liebling.
Madam Chair, I thought you might. Yeah, so, well, that's good to know. That's good to know. Of course, after DOGE, who knows what data is really private anymore that the feds have, because we know that there's all kinds of consolidation of databases, and it's pretty hard to know how data is being used. But I appreciate that there are, in fact, laws that protect that data that gets submitted. Thank you.
Chair Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I was on the conference committee last year, and I cannot tell you how painful it was to make these changes to the miscellaneous expense allowance and all the different levers we had to do to try to do what we thought was filling the state grant hole, and we were so proud of ourselves, and then it didn't happen, right? So as we as a legislature look at this again, knowing that we're probably looking at another deficit, do you have recommendations on which of these levers are best for us to use?
To the testifiers. Go ahead, Ms. Flores.
Madam Chair, Representative, I'm not sure that that the governor's recommendations are yet public. I imagine once they are, we'll be invited back to this committee to discuss them in more depth.
There you go. There you go. Any further questions? Nope. All right. Any other member questions? Well, thank you so much for your testimony today. It was very informative. Thanks for the hard work that you do. Appreciate all three of you, even though we have someone that was never introduced at the table. With that, members, we are adjourned.